This is David Noble, and you're about to hear the fifth edition of Edutalk, which was recorded on Thursday, the 27th of January 2011, and looked into ensuring excellent science education in Scotland. On the panel were Fergal Kelly, Sinclair McKenzie, Nick Hood, and Drew Burritt. I began by asking them to introduce themselves and to reflect on the state of science education presently. If you have any comments or queries, please email edutalkr, that's edutalkr, at mail.co.uk.
Hi, Nick Hughes. I'm a physics teacher at Kilkenny High School in Fife. In education for possibly, 5-6 years now, and thoroughly enjoying it. Background in industry and IT, trying to use the best of my IT skills to improve what I do in education for kids and for other people too. Some of you might know my audio booths, which are a weekly feature. I can speak from personal experience, I guess, which is within a state school of limited resources and a long period of sort of underinvestment in renewing and procuring new equipment. However, I think that what I'm finding is that science teachers are extremely resourceful and they try very, very hard as much as they can to keep the relative subjects, the biology, the physics and the chemistry, as practical as they possibly can make it. Now, I think there's a wide range of experience for kids right across the country. And even within schools, I think there are many teachers that tend to shy away from practical experience just because finding the kit, putting it together and having a decent state of repair is something that's quite a problem. However, I mean, you do what you can. You keep your eye close to what other people are doing. If you can see somebody else using a piece of kit for something you haven't thought of before, then it's a great opportunity to pick it up and try it yourself. There are some great ideas, and I would say this because I'm quite biased, but I think that the Institute of Physics it does a fantastic job in supporting physics teaching in Scotland, in fact, right across the UK and the rest of the world. But in Scotland in particular, we've got a really strong network of physics teachers that work together to share ideas and resources. An illustration of that is I went to a CPD event. It was a teach meet up in Dundee about 2 years ago, and we had some people from Robert Gordon's come down. They showed a video of a piece of equipment they put together called a Rubin's tube, which I'd never heard of before. Well, a year later, I had my own. I've got the specs. So I got a technician to build it for me. Had a bit of old pipe and wire and a bit of broken broken computer. We used some bits and pieces out of that. So I think what's happening is there's still a determination to keep the subject as practical as possible, but we're having to be ever more imaginative and resourceful, reliant as we are on the support we get from our technical support staff, our technicians. If you've got good technical staff in your school that support the education, support the teachers by working hard on keeping equipment in a good state of repair, then I think that this reflects very directly in the quality of teaching that's done in the classroom and the experience that the kids have. Like I say, I think it's very variable, and I think it's down to individual people to make the individual difference in each of their classrooms. And we do our best, I think. I think David's asking you if you could just give us your thoughts on where you think science education is in Scotland at the moment.
Ah, super. Thank you. Okay. Right. I think it's in a great place because, for me, I believe very strongly that science education needs to move away from viewing the world as viewing science as fact and being interested overly, in fact, and start moving towards skills and scientific thinking and inquiry. And the research says that, and we're lucky to be working in a system where the policy says that too. And so I think we've got massive potential in Scotland just now with the result of treatment for reference. I don't know if everyone agrees.
Nick, what do you think of what Kurt has had to say there?
I think it's a very valid point, and I think that there's an expectation, or at least a perception amongst maybe non-science teachers, that the science is often taught as a series of facts, which are just given as like historical facts, where there's no dispute about when such a thing was occurred in history. It's often thought that science facts are presented in this kind of way. I think there is a move away from that kind of teaching, and I think that there's been a move away from that kind of teaching for a very long time. Certainly all the time that I've been a teacher, which is only less than 10 years, the science that's been taught, particularly at the higher level, for kids that are sort of 14, 15, and are more cognitively able to take this idea of uncertainty on board, the physics is very often taught, and the other sciences, I think, also are taught. Very much is to say that these are a set of models. These are a set of understandings that we have, and these are our understanding of how the universe works, based upon what we think it works like, and how closely our evidence, our experimental evidence, matches our idea of how it works. And I think that I'd like to certainly continue the move towards explaining and showing what's happening at the cutting edge of science, and this sort of discovery approach, this inquiry-based approach that Fergal mentioned there, is a brilliant way to do it, to do a little bit of research, to see where it is that our models are good and solid and robust, and where it is that they have limits. And the changes taking place in the curriculum, particularly in the higher and the advanced higher, I think is, again, moving in that direction. Particularly because we now have a great deal more of relativity and areas like that, which are still very much models, although there's a lot of empirical and scientific evidence to support them, they are still models, and they could be broken down at any one point just by a single discovery which provides evidence that the models are incorrect and we need to go away and think about them again.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with Nick, actually. I don't think this is anything new. I think good teachers, good science teachers, have been approaching science in this way for quite some time, and in increasing numbers and increasing numbers of lessons, if that makes sense. But I think we are lucky is that it's seeped into policy, and so it's no longer the expected that good teachers say that, it's expected that all teachers should be using that approach. And then where, as Nick already pointed out, that the SQA are beginning to say, right, well, if that's part of the course, then if our assessment of that course is going to be valid, then part of the assessment needs to capture some of that learning. And so I don't for one second suggesting that this is new, but I think we're when you hear some of the statements from some governments not too far away from here, then I genuinely believe that we are lucky to be in an environment where the policy and the assessments are beginning to reflect that best practice, and it's not just the exception, no longer acceptable to be the exception, if that makes sense.
Okay, just before we move on to the first of a series of questions that some of our panellists have suggested to be covered tonight and feed other people across Scottish education, I'm going to try and bring Sinclair McKenzie in. Sinclair, again, if you could just give us a brief idea of who you are, and then following that, if you could give us your opinion on where science education is at the moment in Scotland.
Hi, David. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, loud and clear.
At last. I teach physics up north. I've been teaching now for 5 years, and I get this terrible reputation as being like IT geek when it comes to science education. And personally, I'm really backing away from that now. I'm trying to get much more like hands-on from equipment. There's a couple of the topics listed on the wiki that I'm very interested in about, do you do experiment, do you use ICT, whatever. I'd like to talk a little bit about what Fergal was talking about there, the whole idea of assessment. I'm very, very pleased to see some of the practical things and researching and handling information coming in for national qualifications. I'm quite sure that Nick will agree that some of the ideas that are coming forward now, for example, for the new higher physics are quite interesting. And one of the problems that I have is actually trying to figure out how can we get that into a system in the lower end of the school. We seem to wrestle on a weekly basis here with what exactly are our curriculum for curriculum for excellent assessment is going to be like. And very, very difficult to get any kind of agreement what that should be like. And it's quite a struggle to move away from the safety of a standard paper-driven test. And it's one of the things that I'm really pushing for. But I'd be quite interested to hear later on what other people think of that as well.
Diego or Nick, would you like to come in at that point, or will we move on to the first topic?
I'm happy to pop in because it's sort of spending. I mean, I spent all day on this very topic actually today in a school. I mean, I think I know everybody's grappling with assessment in the broad general education in S1 to 3, but then, I don't know. If we are assessing what we're, the purposes of the learning, so if we have, we're planning some learning and we take our experiences outcomes and we look at the outcome part of those and what that's what we're interested in assessing, and we think, is that knowledge and understanding? Is it skills? Is it aptitudes? Or is it a mixture of those? And then from that we think, right, what is the evidence of that learning going to be? And naturally, when you do that, it has to be a variety of evidence because of the way the experiences and outcomes are written. And for me, if there's anybody pushing for anything other than a variety of evidence, then most likely when they look back at the experiences and outcomes and look back at what the purposes of the learning are, then those assessments aren't going to be valid and they're not going to capture in the curriculum. And that's, for me, end of argument. That's my opinion.
I've got a couple of things to say about that, and I think that skills assessment is at the heart of the new curriculum, particularly in the lower school, and it's something that's been activating me and the working group I'm on at school very much lately. I've picked up some interesting ideas from the Scottish Learning Festival last year, where some suggestions are made about how you might gather evidence, how you might catch individual children exhibiting some of these skills that are identified. And the SDI has come up with a list of skills that they think are appropriate to science, and they've published those. And it's a great long list. And some of them appear to be directly linked to science, general science skills, like practical skills and conducting experiments and sharing information and recording, that kind of thing. But there's a great deal of other set of, another set of skills in there that they've identified, some of which are very sort of nebulous. One in particular that stands out as being quite questionable for me would be the skill of employability, which is on their list. Now, although it's just a suggested list, that's got about 40 odd items on it, and I think it'd be useful, what we're trying to do now is to pare this down into something that's directly relevant to the experiences that kids have in the classroom. And finding a way of identifying how kids overcome these individual skills and how they demonstrate how they're complying with those things. The experiences and outcomes that we're overcoming at each of the stages within the course, which I guess the framework for the courses that we're building for S1 to S3, is one thing. But there's hidden in that is assessing the skills, which depends entirely on what mechanisms you're using. In other words, what the children are actually doing in the classroom. And I think that one of the issues of the new curriculum is that there's a wide range of implementations. So although we've got a fairly small set of outcomes to overcome in S1 and S2 for, let's just say, science, within the physics area, there's some outcomes on waves, which relates to sound and light. Those outcomes are partly prescriptive. In the experiences they had, for example, they had to experience understanding of how waves of travel through various different objects by looking at how animals communicate. Now, that's very prescriptive and very descriptive, and I think it constrains you to some extent. But even then, there's going to be a wide range of how people take that and turn it into a course which presents itself as a set of experiences in the classroom for the kids. And in there, there's a second level of abstraction, if you like, of the skills that the children are going to identify, are going to experience and demonstrate in the classroom. So it is a horribly nebulous and difficult area. And I'd like to see some sort of national standardisation, if you like, of what we expect within the science curriculum, perhaps driven more by scientists than by an SQA maths somewhat removed from the classroom.
Okay, just at this point, sorry to break in this kind of fascinating point in the discussion, but I'm going to just try and bring Drew in again. Drew, can you hear me, and would you like to try and place your mic, please?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
It's the crispest line in the conversation, I think. So, Drew, you've probably managed to catch most of the...
I've heard pretty much everything.
Just a brief introduction, if you don't mind.
As a teacher, I work in a secondary school in Helmsborough. I've been in post about 5 years. I'm also a GLOW mentor. I've worked in a variety of different kind of scales of school, a very small school in the Borders, a very large school in the southeast of England, and a private school in Madrid. Very interested in technology and teaching and learning. Obviously, very, you know, doing everything I can to make curriculum for excellence work for my pupils as well as myself.
Yeah, to come in on what Nick and Fergal have been saying about assessment, that is, to me, the essence of CFE is that we're going to assess the things that are important rather than the things that are just easy to assess, which is what we've always done. Assessment has always seemed to be done in the way that it's done because it's a straightforward, standardised way of measuring something that's easy to measure rather than because it has any significant value. And one of my great worries is how we go about assessing the skills, assessing the attributes that we want to build in our pupils when it's a very new way of assessing anything at all. I think the NAR has been kind of step in the right direction, but it does, as Nick points out, need some greater level of exemplification. And definitely I would agree with Nick in terms of it needing to be done by people who are, if you like, at the chalk face rather than people who are removed from things at the examination board or at LTS. I'm sure there are a lot of great ideas out there, and it's finding ways of sharing and also evaluating them, because it's all very well for people to come up with their own activities and methods of performing their assessment, but I think it's very difficult to know if you're heading in the right direction unless you can get some sort of feedback. And certainly in terms of the development of our new courses for CFE, where I am, one of the things I've been really pushed for is time to properly evaluate what we've been doing so far. And there's a real danger that because we're so short of time, that we just continue to implement things and don't take the time and don't make the time to take a step back and look and see how beneficial and worthwhile what we've been doing is.
I'll just bring Sinclair in here. And Sinclair, she's the first person to mention the National Assessment Resource, and certainly the early days of GLOW, people were talking about being able to share resources, and I would assume that would be potentially the included assessment instruments. What are your feelings towards these particular sort of technology-based possibilities for maybe a bottom-up approach to assessment items and the writing and the sharing of things? Is that something that can happen? Are there tools out there or things happening within your council that could lead to some kind of successful scheme? Or do you have a different approach to creating these assessment items that are so best that we really differentiate?
Well, I think two other colleagues had a look through what was available on the NAR, and of course we haven't developed anything ourselves, and we were wondering, could we kind of piggyback, you know, could we find something that was suitable for our particular needs at this point in time? And there wasn't actually anything there, because of course one of the things is everyone's doing it all a little bit differently. It's all open to interpretation, and of course, it's not just the individual teacher's interpretation. There's a departmental or a school interpretation. Perhaps you've got a local authority one. Maybe you've got subject supporters in your local authority. And all these people have a bit of input. And, you know, it kind of changes the experience depending on where you are in the country. So we ended up building our own. They're very much a work in progress. We're still on it. And we're still kind of, I would say we're not at the stage of putting anything out there to share yet, probably because we're still kind of at a very loose and informal departmental meeting, kind of like passing things about and sharing ideas, almost like an internal quality review process. Perhaps if we were quite secure in the knowledge that we thought we had good resources right now, we'd be looking to put them out there. I mean, GLOW is one vehicle for it. I kind of come and go on GLOW a little bit, but it is something that every teacher should have access to. So that makes it a handy vehicle to let sharing take place. But for example, there would be nothing to stop people sharing it. There are different places where people who teach physics share resources, but I feel that might exclude people who are biology and chemistry teachers, because I don't know what resources they have.
I think the best enough area for discussion on the record that follows on from this would be, I suppose it kind of ties in with one of the key aspects of the change to the new curriculum, the idea of moving away from kind of the skewed body of knowledge to learning and the various of that, of course. So I'll go to point 6 on the wiki, and the question is, why do we continue to present scientific knowledge as if it is fact without exploring the evidence? And I'll just throw that open to the panel, and anyone can come in when they're ready.
I think I'll jump in there, I was just going to say, I think that we've kind of mentioned that a wee bit already, in the sense that I don't think it's true that we present scientific knowledge as if it's fact. I don't think that's the case at all. I think that what's possibly presented or interpreted as fact is presented as what we know so far and what we understand in terms of models at the more complex levels, the higher levels for chemistry and physics and I think indeed biology. But I think that rather than presenting facts, I think what we're presenting is discoveries. And I think that all the while we're presenting what's been discovered, it's been linked pretty much how it's been discovered, how it is that, for example, acids and alkalines are considered as such, and what it is that makes them acid or alkaline is just merely our understanding of what's happening at one level. And when people go on to study chemistry at a further level, they get a much greater, a deeper understanding of what our model is of acids and alkalines, and they realize that it's just, there's a human element to that, and it's our interpretation of science and our methods of interacting with the real universe that underlies the models that we use to describe those things. So I think it's a fallacy to say that we present scientific knowledge as its fact. I don't think that's something that's done. And I think that the evidence very much is explored, and the way it's explored is to allow the children to explore it themselves by getting their hands on and mixing some chemicals and using universal indicators and identifying those things that not only in the lab, but also when they go home, they look at the antacid tablet that their dad's taking because he's had too rich a curry for his dinner. They can talk perhaps knowledgeably about what the process is taking place inside dad's stomach when he swallows the rennet. I think that's the case because the children have experienced taking a rennet or taking some alkaline, putting it to the universal indicator and seeing what's happening
and then showing what happens when you neutralize it, when you neutralize an acid with it. And I think that that knowledge is there. It's very much experimentally based, particularly where it's taught well.
True.
I agree with Nick at the level at which he's discussing that. I think that part of the reason that scientific knowledge seems to be perceived as fact is because I think that's generally how the examination boards treat them. These are set pieces of, to use their terminology, knowledge and understanding. And an implication in that terminology is that these are essentially immutable facts, and regardless of how it's necessarily delivered, I think the assumption is the scientific knowledge is a fact, I suppose, as much due to semantics as anything else. And there is a danger. I think many of us would agree that where we're driven by examination courses and examination deadlines and examination arrangements, that we don't often have the time or make the time to explain the difference between fact and knowledge and the models that Nick has already discussed and what it is that's required for the examination. And I think there's a very great opportunity in Curriculum for Excellence where we have this freedom, where we have the kind of opportunity to move around within our subject to discuss the wider issues of knowledge and models and facts and how those differ from each other. But certainly further up the school, where we are driven very much by exams and examination results upon which we're judged to a very large extent, I think there's a real danger of things coming across as being facts simply because there aren't the opportunities to discuss the alternatives and maybe to have the discoveries that our pupils have at a lower level than the school, where the opportunities are more readily available.
I'd like to invite you to think for our head at this point.
Could I come in just now, David? I was just going to say that I think part of the problem with this presenting scientific knowledge as fact rather than allowing pupils to explore for themselves is to do with how secure is the teacher's understanding of the subject. And I think that we can be very risk averse in the classroom. And I'm not just talking about kids who are sitting national qualifications. I'm talking even further down the school. And it is one of the things that worries me a bit with Curriculum for Excellence, the thought of 3 years of teaching general science. I'm quite secure in my knowledge of physics that whatever I happen to do in first to third year is going to be okay. I could probably handle the chemistry, but there are serious gaps in my knowledge that would allow me, for example, to just let something go on a biology topic and see where it takes us, because I've got no idea either where that's going to take us. And I do think that there's a real need for teachers to be secure in what they're doing, just so that they can feel that they can open up and take the risk and say, yeah, let's go and explore, let's see what's happening here. You know, it's a very kind of risk averse mentality. So, you know, sit back and just deliver as fact because you're scared that perhaps someone's going to do something and say, you know, they might challenge what you think is actually going on.
Yeah, I mean, I actually put that question on there, and it's something. I mean, I actually put it on there not as it because I think lots of teachers do this, but I'm pretty sure I have, and I've done it quite a lot. The first time my eyes were really open to it was when I taught higher psychology, where because the models are so far from fact that they can't, so they have to learn it as a model, and they have to learn the different models, and they have to weigh up and balance the different ones because they are so contested still. And it really sort of opened my eyes to the way that I deliver biology, and it's the complete opposite. It's rarely is something discussed as a model. And I agree with, I can't remember who it was who was saying that perhaps that I mean, I'm to blame, but perhaps the way that the qualification system is structured is to blame as well. And I mean, because certainly it's possible in the higher psychology for it to be different, and so why not a little bit different in biology? But I mean, even in the lower school, I understand the point of the you know, the lack of confidence of teaching general science. I taught general science in England, where I trained and taught for the first 3 years, and it can be tricky. But I think what's most important is that young people learn science before splitting it into disciplines. I do believe that in my own school it's split far too early, and so they don't have a concept of the relationship between the sciences. And I think that so the solution isn't to separate them. It's more of a professional development. It's learning to take risks in our own subject where we are confident, and learning the other subjects and gradually taking more and more risks in those. And I think through that we'll get there. But it won't be easy, and it won't be quick.
Can I jump in there, David? Was that the next one
you go?
Fogel and I had quite an interesting and open discussion about this, I think, online with a couple of articles that we both wrote on our respective blogs. I was one that was suggesting that it's important to allow a teacher to teach their own subject, even low down the school, because of their richer knowledge and possibly greater enthusiasm for their subject that will allow them to have that confidence to be in the zone of discomfort or uncertainty, to emphasise this point. I take your point, Virgil, that it is a development opportunity for teachers. For example, myself, if I have to teach, as has been suggested, that science teachers will have to teach all the way up to level 4 across the 3 sciences, not necessarily within their own specialisation. That's going to be a massive development task for me, to get myself not just to the level of knowledge that the kids are going to have to learn, but also to the level that I can appreciate how secure that knowledge is, how good those models are, where the uncertainties are, where the sort of historical implications have been for people that have brought that knowledge to us over the years. And I would welcome the opportunity, but I think that that's a massively expensive thing in terms of development time, and I can't see there being the opportunity in the teacher contract to give us that time to make that development necessary, to give us the same rich experience that the kids are going to have outside of our particular subject specialisation.
So I'm aware that we've only got about 5 or 10 minutes left, so I'm going to try and do something. I'm going to try and bundle 3 questions into one, and just while I'm preparing to do that, remember that if you're listening to the live streaming, we're all about after. I think there are a fair number listening to the live stream, and then feel free to send a tweet and it's a comment which will be read out, or ask a question to the panel, and you can also email it as well. So I'm again looking back at the wiki. So I mentioned it just a few moments ago there about modelling and about the opportunities that lessons are offering us to do things differently, and to maybe model experiments that possibly could have been done in the past. So I'll just read out a few questions and see if we can bundle them into one. I'm going to ask Cynthia to come in first. The science is a practical subject. Can it be taught without equipment? And you know, what kind of areas of the web, or which organisations or which resources are best for offering, for example, animations and simulations instead of practical experiments in the classroom? And I suppose tied in with that, and thinking about the recent Donaldson report on teacher education, what role can higher education play in, I suppose, partnering schools to deliver science education? So partnering in terms of actually a physical presence in schools, or working within the academy and getting people out to university. Also in terms of maybe creating some of these virtual or online resources that might be able to enhance science education. So a huge question. They're talking about doing things differently, talking about using technology, talking about maybe moving away from necessarily all this hands-on in the classroom, and thinking about these opportunities that Donaldson seem to be providing for not necessarily schools of education, but actually science faculties within universities to become more involved in the education of the people and the training of student teachers. So there's a biggie for you, Cynthia, when you go.
Thanks, David. I used to use an awful lot of animations, like an awful lot. The crocodile physics, the crocodile chemistry. I would quite happily project these up onto a board and show kids how to do things. And it's only really now that I've been in the classroom a few years that I've realised that, you know, kids, they'll sit and they'll watch and they might well see it as entertainment, but I actually think that they learn so much better by doing. And you can see them get involved and it encourages discussion. You can see them arguing about the best way to do something or they look at their own results and they see they've done something wrong, and once they get the blame thing out of the way, they'll go back and they'll try and do something again. I'm really liking science being practical again in my classroom. I still use animations and simulations. I actually put up a whole lot of links to them on my website for kids who use my site for revision, for like standard grade, prelims, higher prelims, that kind of thing. But what really struck me was about 2 years ago, I'd had a kid in a standard grade class, and he'd come up to me after the prelim, and he'd said, you know, he says, we didn't do this stuff in class, and it was in the exam. I said, well, yes, we did. And remember, I said, I showed him the website, and I said, and we did that, and I showed what happened here, and we spoke about how you could use this for, I think it was for generating electricity or something. And he just turned around and he says, but you can program a computer to show you anything. I was so taken aback by that. And afterwards I thought, you know, maybe you do actually have to see these things happening for real, just in front of you with your own eyes, and not have someone program it. So I have made a conscious decision to go back to doing a lot more hands-on science in the classroom. I don't know what other people have thoughts about that. I don't know how well for time, but I'd be interested to hear.
I've got something to say on that, as ever. Just to say that the role of the higher education establishments, I think, is very, very important to us, particularly at the higher and the advanced higher level. And I'm very lucky in Fife to have St Andrews University close by, which is a very, very positive and supportive approach towards supporting students in secondary schools. In fact, this very afternoon, we have an advanced higher student going up to St Andrews University, who for his investigation is going to do a notoriously difficult malignant soil drop experiment. This in the school is nigh on impossible to do it. If anybody's ever tried to do it, they'll know how extraordinarily difficult that is to do. But I know that guy this afternoon, and I told him before he went, you're going to be one of very few people who have ever actually got Millikan's oil drop experiment to work, because I know that they have brand new facilities up there at St Andrews. I took this up there last year. I'm privileged to say that I've done Millikan's oil drop experiment and got it to work and got good results from it. And that would be absolutely impossible without support of higher education faculties. If you compare that with a simulation of the same thing, the simulation, as Sinclair's pupil rightly points out, any idiot can program a computer to make something happen on a screen. And their experience with the Xbox and so on demonstrates that, how unreal you can make real things seem, or how real you can make unreal things seem on a computer. It's a suspension of belief. When you see the real, then the learning is solid and secure for a very long time. And I think that that's the one justification for practical that is a thousand times better than any animation.
I mean, I jump in there. I mean, I'm fascinated by what Sinclair said. I mean, I found myself going down a very similar road, actually, when I first started teaching and getting really into the IT and at one point, and just, you know, wanting to use as much IT as possible. And I can't remember, it wasn't as clear and interesting, critical incident as Sinclair, but I just, at one point, thought, you know, this is just one tool, and with many limitations and pulled back from becoming quite so obsessed with using IT in my lessons and tried to think about trying to use it when it was appropriate, when it was going to add value, when it was the best learning resource, and not just use it as much as possible, which is kind of where I was headed before. And so, I mean, I'm fascinated to hear him say the same thing. On the higher education thing, I mean, it's really interesting. What I was this evening is we've just finished an 8-week program with the EdBee Solian Science teachers, and it was a course called Pisces, Promoting Inquiry Skills for Curriculum for Excellence in Science. And it was run by Strathclyde University staff, and it's been really successful, and the teachers have carried out a lot of the things we've been talking about this evening and taken some risks and been supported by the university. And it's been a fantastic relationship. And it can be, you know, not just about providing, well, not only about providing those opportunities for the higher and advanced faculties, but it can be a great support for professional development as well.
I don't think that any of us would prefer to any extent to use any animation or simulation where a perfectly simple, straightforward piece of practical exists that we can do. But increasingly, due to cut budgets and a lack of funding, certainly in the time that I've taught in Scotland, the last 10 years, there's been cut and cut and cut. And a great deal of the equipment that we use for our practical work is simply very, very expensive for a variety of different reasons. And there's a real worry, certainly where I'm concerned, that where virtually no budget exists to replace old equipment which is on its way out, or to buy new equipment, certainly in the light of new national qualifications that are in the pipeline, how can we continue to do practical subject with practical experimentations if there is no prospect of being able to secure the necessary apparatus? And I think perhaps there might be a role with higher education in perhaps being involved in the development of certain apparatus. I mean, all of the physics people here will be aware of the massive benefit of a piece of apparatus known as the Jordan Hill air bearing to teach rotational dynamics. And I can't think of anything of a similar kind of stature in terms of equipment that's been developed by an education establishment for use in schools. I don't know if anybody else is aware of anything.
I'm not actually, Drew, but what you're talking about, replacing and getting apparatus, is quite a big issue. And one of the things that goes against me is just simple geography, trying to get a kid to go down to a university. I mean, Aberdeen is probably my closest one, but you're still a whole day on the train, and then, you know, you probably can't get back even the next day if you're going to be going into the university's teaching labs. One of the ways that I have been able to get around this is thanks to CERC in Dunfermline. They're very, very good at sending out equipment to outlying schools, and they can let you keep it until such time as, say, a pupil has finished their advanced higher, that chunk of their advanced higher investigation, and then you just bundle it up and send it back to them. And I've found them to be very supportive in that area.
Okay, just as we get to the last couple of minutes, folks, a couple of comments via Twitter. Walter Patterson, who's an independent consultant and former HMI, says that pupils doing live experiments allows them to talk to others and make mistakes, so I think he's in favour of that. He does say that science animation could or should be used, but with caution. And Christian Smith, who is a CBT teacher, in Edinburgh, works in Glasgow, and says that being a CBT teacher, it's impossible for me to be highly confident in all areas, but for me there lies the excitement of learning and teaching. And so as I said, just as we come to the final couple of minutes, would anyone like to come in with a last comment?
Yeah, just to say, what a great enriched discussion we've had, and I can't believe how quick the time has gone by. A brilliant enriched discussion. I think that if only we were at a pub, we could continue it into the wee small hours and still not solve the problems, but certainly agree on a number of areas. But the practical aspect of teaching science is it's a given, and without practical, it isn't science.
Well, we'll finish up there, folks. You were listening to Virgo Kelly, who is at Beth Kelly on Twitter, Drew Burdett, who is at Drew Burdett, that's with two R's and two C's. Nick Hoods at Alalo, C-U-L-L-A-L-O-E, and Clifford McKenzie, who's Mr. McKenzie, that's M-A-C on Twitter. This entire production cost over some £3.53, which is my Skype bill. And I will talk and fail the recording, which will go out on edutalk.cc later on this evening. I think there will be quite a bit of editing, particularly with my shoddy Skype and podcasting skills, which I think after 6 years, I might have managed to refine. But thanks very much, guys. I know I stepped in at the last moment. I'm hoping that a couple of very respected scientists who have a great interest in education will take up the offer that was made to me of sharing a future discussion, and that's something that I think would be a very rich follow-up based on some of the strands of this evening's discussion. So thanks again to Fergal, to Joe, Nick and Sinclair, and hope to help to build the next show, which will be sometime in March. So thanks very much, and talk to you again soon.